Welcome to What's Left, the weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host and teacher and socialist Andy Lipson and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. Please subscribe, rate, review, and share your favorite episode wherever you found this episode. Thank you. Today, we are joined by our wonderful contributor and frequent guest, Alison McDowell. She is a dedicated researcher studying and on the working parts of the World Economic Forum, and also has discussed plenty of times with us on the Fourth Industrial Revolution and the global takeover of industries and public policies by the central banks, multinational corporations, and tech and big tech technocrats and billionaire-funded foundations. Alison's work can be found on Wrench in the Gears. If anyone is interested, I highly recommend people go over to her blog and check out her work. Thank you, Alison, for joining us once again.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So today we will be discussing of the recent headlines some weeks ago on GameStop and anything around that fiasco that has to do with banking, centralized money, and cryptocurrency. And we'll be having our different takes on it, but as well trying to sort it out, because it seems to be something that was unprecedented in that sort of the world of stock exchange and the world of stocks and markets. So I hope that we can have a lively discussion on it.
Yeah, and the reason that I reached out to you, Alison, to invite you here was because the more I thought about this stuff that has been going on with GameStop recently and Citadel coming in and the government coming in and just to watch how hedge funds operate, it made me really think about some of the work you've done to talk about impact investing and data collection of students, of workers in relationship to the financial markets and the financial system that we have. And so I think for me, GameStop became like a student that could be invested on and shorted, or you know, raise your, and all those sorts of things. It highlighted that when we see what can happen to GameStop, what happens when you put human outcomes in that same system?
Right. Because most people aren't, I mean, unless you're in that business thinking about making money when things are bad for a company. Most people think of investments, just the average person would be like, oh, I invest in a company and it does well, and then I make money off of that. And they're not necessarily, unless you're in that space, thinking about like, oh, some people are making money when you intentionally tank companies, right? And that's, I think, the benefit of the GameStop scenario is to acclimate people to that reality.
Mm-hmm. As well as supposedly user-friendly apps that were used that were supposed to make that accessible for a lot of people to make money in these areas that have suddenly turned on the people that were putting in dollars. There's that element as well to it. Maybe we can just talk about GameStop. I don't know if that might be just a quick summary of what we understand of what happened in that fiasco.
Yeah, maybe I'll start with just the few things that I know is that, so GameStop is a retail company and a number of retail companies, AMC and there's another one, Blackberries, and a number of them had been seen as being vulnerable because they weren't going in the e-commerce direction. They weren't doing enough e-commerce. They were brick and mortar stores. And that, you know, it's actually estimated that 50% of retail stores are going to be collapsing in the next year or so. I think I read something like that. And so it was apparently some hedge funds, those are considered the big guys, were essentially shorting GameStop stock. And that, which basically meant that you make money on the idea that GameStop stock will lower in value, and the amount that it lowers in value is the amount of money you make. So there were big guy hedge funds. Melvin Capital was the big one mentioned. I think there were others involved as well that were shorting GameStop. And then the story goes is that a bunch of Reddit kind of Wall Street Bets investors, a kind of crowdsourced group of little guy investors came in and pushed the stock up, kind of hedged it up. And that set loose a series of things where the people who had shorted need to pay for their losses now that the value of the stock's going up. And as they buy the stock itself, that goes up more in value. So it set up a cascade of the stock going higher and higher in value. And then everyone who had shorted it losing more and more of their lunch. And then, of course, the other part of the story was this Robinhood app. That was the way that these folks got into the little guys got into the market. Apparently, you know, Robinhood app was the way they got in, but it was also the way for shutting it down, because that's at one point Robinhood, and it seems to be in conjunction with the company Citadel, which then buys out or now has a controlling or has a major interest now in Melvin after coming in and helping Melvin out to survive the hedge fund disaster. The short squeeze disaster that they went through. Well, Citadel seems to have worked in conjunction to get Robinhood to kind of stem the bleeding by saying, you know what, hey, stop people from buying copies of GameStop stock. You can sell it, but you can't buy it. And let's, of course, Robinhood said, that's not why we did that, and blah, blah, blah. But overall, it seemed to be a story of the little guys taking down the big guys, and also a story of the big guys coming in and again treating the market like a casino. And when the casino starts to lose money, they come in and bring in any forces they can to help themselves stay afloat. And then, of course, initially the government, in looking at this, again seemed to go in and say and describe the Reddit, the Wall Street Bets people as sort of like the financial investment version of the insurrectionists, you know, like they're these unwashed people who are all racists and white supremacists, and they have to be shut down on Discord. So it came off with a slew of like like censorship that entered into the thing as well. So there was just seemed like there was a rigged system in play, and that's sort of the story that was the main elements of the story that I caught. I'm not saying that that's all that, I'm just saying that's the story that I heard that was told about it. And people are free to add other pieces that they think are important. Because since looking into it, it's, to me, this is no longer a big guy versus little guy story. But I'll just say that's what I first heard.
I do think there is one more piece that I find important, that when they shut down these small investors, you know, that were going against the hedge funds, they were making arguments of market manipulation, when in fact the very act of shorting these stocks, so buying them and selling them, is market manipulation, because by flooding the markets, they're forcing, you know, it's supply and demand. You're, you know, putting a bunch of stocks there, so you're decreasing the value of this, and you know, because the big guys are making the move to sell, then other people follow and sell too. And so that ensures that the prices decrease and they make their money by decreasing the value of the stock. And eventually, you know, and so, yeah, again, and the argument was that these people, that not the big players, right, like the small people were cheating the system, when cheating was part of the system.
It's an error part of the system.
And either Eduardo or Allison, do you have any elements that you want to add that you might have heard that are like kind of the lore of the story?
I mean, I think that's about as much as, I mean, how did it end up at the very end? Because I sort of like, I know that they were encouraging people to pour more and more money in to keep it up. And then I think part of my concern, like that I was hearing, was that it was a way of luring people in who didn't really know how these markets worked and that they were going to lose money eventually. And so what was, as the story built, it was sucking more and more funds in from people who felt like they wanted to be part of this charismatic moment, but they didn't fully appreciate the risks or what might be involved in them putting, like joining in this cause that was sort of set up as a David and Goliath thing. And I don't know how it all ended out at the end. Like, is it done? Like, is the company gone, or did people cash out, or I don't.
You mean GameStop or Melvin?
Yeah, like the little people. Like, did they make money? Some people make money. I didn't keep track of how it ended.
I do know some of that, and maybe Eduardo, you can speak to that as well.
I don't know about that part, Andy.
There were definitely a number of people on the Wall Street Bets group that made good money, big money. And then some of them did these high profile, like, we're going to help little people out kind of things, right?
Yeah.
And then I've also known that Wall Street Bets as a group had 900,000 users, and now it has 8.3 million users on it. You know, so it's definitely grown. It's definitely, this moment has drawn people in, not just the Wall Street Bets, but it's drawn people into the market like, oh, look, we can make it too. Like, there's an opportunity here. And that to me is part of the story here.
Come seek your fortune, young man, in the app.
Right.
And I think it also lures people in on the idea that you can stick it to the big guy, right? Like, you know, and gain something out of it. But I mean, what to me it's important to note is that yes, it caused outrage, but it died out, you know, and it's done basically. Even if, you know, I don't know what's happening behind the scenes, it's like, yes, it exposed a bit of the system, right? Of how, like you said, Allison, you make money out of betting on the failure of a company, yeah. Right? With the popular sense is that if a company is successful, you're going to make money. But there were these big guys making a lot of money in silence, basically, until this happened. And yes, it caused a lot of outrage, but it's fizzled away.
And I mean, the other thing that I think that is interesting is, like, my understanding on these big trades, you know, in the markets, these day trading and the major trades, is that, like, a lot of it is giant trades and AI. It's not just, I mean, there's some that sort of boutique people sitting around and doing the research and saying, oh, like, this is, but that I don't know that that's the norm for hedge funds, that they're treated in this way, you know, in this sort of very prescriptive, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think as an industry, it's not the norm how this played out. And so the story of sort of implying that that's the norm is also somewhat deceptive.
I think I'll add that people like my friend Jake, who's been on this, on What's Left before, he was really disappointed by Robin Hood's act and role in this, and not being able to or having faith, rather, in that such companies such as Robinhood and applications like that would be able to allow them to compete with people who have a lot of wealth. And that wasn't true, as we saw. So that's the only comment I wanted to make about that. And share as well that this is has also, at least my understanding, and maybe some of you can see it differently, is that after this whole fiasco, though, there was also that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies were able to were rising up. The price for Bitcoin was shot up, and especially with the endorsement of Elon Musk. Is it something that I'm still trying to figure this one out. But I've been convinced almost that cryptocurrency is the way to go. And I saw something in Allison's share of our email that maybe it's not. And
More sophisticated technology than just currency.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, my research is more about blockchain, of which the currency is a part and not insubstantial part, but it's certainly not the whole story. There's a lot of other stuff that's going to come that comes under it in terms of Ethereum smart contracts that and the spatial computing web that people don't know. And so I think that the Bitcoin mania is giving cover to stuff that is actually going to be pretty dark, but people don't know about it yet. They don't understand it, but we can talk about that later. I don't want to derail, but I will say, like, cause some of this stuff is, I always thought when I was doing this research early on that it was like semantics, like having some sort of background in like language analysis seemed really important because the way in which the language is used felt significant to me like early on. And then the more I sort of looked at things, you know, they were talking about really almost like spell casting with words, like how you use words or the symbolism that is in the visuals. And I think we know anytime something blows up in the media, there's a reason for it, right? Like the media is in the hands of what, 5 or 6 companies. And so if it's decided that this is the thing, like how many other things like this have happened that nobody gets media coverage, but that it is Robinhood is the framing this app. So that gets very high play. And then GameStop, because we know, and this kind of goes into the blockchain, the stuff that I've talked about, is that we are on this edge of spatial computing, like three-dimensional computing, like where we're actually living in a computing system that's outside of a screen through wearable technology and smart technology, so that it's almost like we're going to live a game. Like the gamification that we see in schools and in healthcare and different things is going to become a lifestyle, and the influence of the Entertainment Software Association over that. So I think it's very interesting that GameStop is the feature stock here, like in this drama that they've picked, you know, the characters, the GameStop is in and of itself a character. And as we're embarking on a world of being dominated by video game technologies, really, of which the currency is part of that. I think it's significant, that choice. I think it's not just by accident that that's how it happened.
Well, I definitely agree that there, that when there's a story like this that takes on this kind of mass media element, then you have to know that there's another story behind the story, and that even and that part of the story is what are they trying to do with pushing this? Like, and you do have to ask that conspiratorially, because it is a conspiracy of the mass media to fix our heads. Right. And so we have to try to figure out what's the game here. And that, I'm not going to sure I have a full answer. And I do think there's a gamification of the world as I see that work increasingly is going to have headsets, and it's going to look a lot like the Pokemon Go game, you know? And so school is going to look like that as well, probably in the future. But there were a few things that were interesting that I want to sit on the story that get at some of the stuff we've talked about. So I want to start with Robinhood. Robinhood got big, because what's been happening is they've been trying to draw more and more investors into more and more money from all sorts of sections of people who have wealth. And let's be clear, if you're going to talk about little guys and big guys, the people we're talking about are the top 1 and 2% wealth earners in the country and possibly on the globe. Like we talked about last episode, income disparity, the top 1% owns the same as the top 40% of the in terms of income. But when you talk about wealth, and that's what we're talking about here when we talk about the money to invest, then we're talking about the top 1% has $35 trillion of wealth, and the bottom 40% has only like $250 billion or something like that. So the numbers are completely off the chart. So the people who are playing around in Wall Street, that's your 1%. So at the very least, what you're talking about is it's the 2% against the 0.5%. Maybe you could say that's what this battle was, but I don't think that's true, because Robinhood, which was trying to draw, you know, make doesn't one of the things it does is doesn't charge you for when you make a transaction. One of the things that's been happening is transaction fees have been getting lower and lower and lower, to the point of Robinhood saying we're not charging you anything. So how does Robinhood make money? It sells the data of the investor. Who does it sell the data of the investor to? Citadel. So who knew that all these investments were coming? Citadel, the same company that buys up Melvin. Turns out Citadel had had both things on GameStop. It had buy things and sell things on GameStop, an equal level of them, all right? So essentially Citadel, which comes in and sweeps in and does socialism for Melvin Capital, is the company that is collecting all the information. Well, it's not the only one, but it's a major owner of Robinhood. And everyone was making a big deal about being an owner of Robinhood and forcing Robinhood to do something, which they might have done. But the real story behind that is that Citadel is getting all the information about what investments are happening, and they're able to watch the entire game. And Citadel is representing Citadel partly posed itself as representing these small-time investors, right? It's got one tentacle of Citadel. I don't want to make this all about Citadel. They're operating like every other fucking capitalist thing, but this is the company I know about, right? Because BlackRock also made a bunch of money on this thing. Like, I want to be clear about that. BlackRock made bank on this whole rising of the thing. So BlackRock is not a little guy. Let's be clear, all right?
No.
But Citadel has one wing of its company, which represents all these smaller investors, the 2%. But then it's got another wing that supposedly only represents like 19 investors, each having about 12.5 billion on average total wealth. And so it's another wing that is like just a few people who swinging around a giant amount of capital and basically leveraging both of those groups and using the information on both those groups to play against each other. So I don't know how they're doing it, but to me, what happens? So at the end of this thing, essentially Citadel comes in and sweeps up Melvin Capital and says, okay, you're a pretty successful hedge fund. You're a smaller fish than us. We're buying you out after we essentially save you from the losses you just incurred, losses that I think Citadel knew that was going to happen to them. So
the prediction.
Yeah. And so this is just one aspect of it in terms of that, to me, exposes the fact that again, there's another story going on here, about how, and that really what these are like various size fish all eating each other. And that, again, this is why I'm so worried. I mean, this is what really made me worry when I think about bringing education into the finance area, health into the finance. These are the monsters who are in play, who are at work here, who we're putting our lives up to. We're putting our education up to, our healthcare up to. If we go through, the human impact investment system that wants to financialize all these things. And collect data to figure out what works and what doesn't.
Right. Well, can I, for people who may not have like listened to our other talks, can I just summarize what that looks like just briefly on the human capital bond side?
Yeah.
So one of the entities when I was doing my education research, and it's actually interesting, the website has since been pulled down, but you can find it on the Wayback Machine. I think it's called, it's Global Education Futures Forum. And they had a timeline of education up to 2035 with all sorts of different points, which hadn't happened yet, but it was a foresight document that was sort of saying they anticipated it, among which included human capital investments, like specifically targeting certain kinds of human capital, quality of human capital, and that there was an item describing people-naires. So it would be like a billionaire who held portfolios of people. And this would be holding portfolios of people, not, I mean, it's a legacy of enslavement in terms of people who would hold a portfolio of enslaved people on a plantation, but in a world of robotics where physical labor, and even skilled labor is less valued, it's behavioral, right? And so what we're talking about now is actually securitizing debt tied to people's use of public benefits and then profiling them as human capital, as like a, you know, akin to a debt on a house, on your mortgage, but you would be represented by your debt on society. So turning, the idea of people from members of your community or children as gifts to the community as a debt burden. Like, and so what is your quality of how much debt are you holding? And what is our prediction on whether or not you can fulfill some repayment of that debt? And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about like aggregating these portfolios and potentially shorting them, is that there are markets being set up in managed poverty to actually package people, not unlike, it's not exactly like the GameStop debt, but trading people as debt in portfolios. And it's the same companies like BlackRock and Blackstone that are involved in it. And it's being reframed now, particularly with Biden coming in and the UN Sustainable Development Goals coming online, as ESG investing, environmental social governance. And so they're saying that this is progressive. This is the good kind of investment. And I think to a certain extent, bringing all these people, like people who might not have considered themselves day traders, in on these apps, it's like a master's tool argument, right? They're selling us that our liberation is connected to using these tools that are actually the tools that are disempowering all the communities and creating this new paradigm. But in the excitement of the moment and the excitement of feeling like you can be empowered by this tool, people are getting swept in and they're not realizing like, it's not our game. Like, we never own this game. We never set the rules of this game. This game is not in our, the advantage of the masses. It's maybe in the advantage of this top 20 people. And that's called pay for success finance or social impact bonds or human capital bonds, just to bring people up to speed if they haven't heard of me talk about it before.
And it's also, but I don't want to get too much into this. It is also seems to be the similar game to be played in the Green New Deal.
Yeah. The financialization of nature and human capital. And I would say if people are not familiar with that, the Green New Deal side of things, like the financialization of nature, particularly Wrong Kind of Green is a blog with a number of contributors, which is very good. And actually one of my favorite economists, who I never thought I would have a favorite economist, but his name is Clive Spash. And he talks about degrowth, like the myth of the carbon credit trading schemes. He was actually, his background is in agroforestry. And then he saw through how it was all being financialized and fake just to channel capital. And it wasn't actually fixing any of the problems. And so he's with them too, but it's really in this moment, because I think COVID and the lockdowns are pushing people into this new narrative. We're going to have this great reset. Now we're going to fix the environment, but it isn't actually about creating a fix. It's about channeling capital and creating these bets.
I suppose then the argument would be then that that's the reason why people who want more control over what over their money would be if a technology based on decentralized network may offer more control over what people do online. And that is why I think it's proposed or suggested that it's best to go with cryptocurrencies. But I guess from Alison's earlier shaking of the head is maybe not the way.
Well, I mean, I think there's two paths, right? And I think some people who, well, one, nobody knows who Satoshi Nakamoto is. And it probably is definitely the deep state. Like, you know, it didn't just happen on the scene. Like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, or, you know, there's maybe somebody in Australia, but like, really, it's there for a reason. It's a master's tool thing. And, you know, we see the central bank digital currencies coming in and they're just going to squash all the other ones. Like, I mean, we're up against global empire, right? Like, if they don't want there to be some other crypto, they're just shut it down. They're going to make it so you can't transact. And, you know, I think, to me, a huge part of the human capital bond program is managing people's like debt in relationship to the state, you know, whatever the state's not just the United States, it's global, especially Commonwealth countries right now. And that they're pushing digital benefits, blockchain benefits, programmable money. That's their goal, is like when people are talking UBI, they're not realizing the end game is programmable money in a digital, like a central banking system wallet. So it will maybe look like Bitcoin, but it'll be like, well, here's your three colored tokens for your housing. And here's a couple tokens for food. And you won't even get to use your wallet the way you want to use it. It's going to be subdivided and it'll live on a device. And this device has a SIM card that can be remotely shut down. Right. And so a lot of this, you have to understand the trajectory that comes out of 9/11 is that when they enacted all of these changes around the banking systems, this know your customer, KYC, it was about like money laundering or whatever, like terrorism or whatever. But what it essentially put into very specific ways of banking transactions and identity transactions. And so while it was ostensibly about like getting the bad guys, the tracking systems around identity and money are very, very granular at this point. And the same with like, once you get a public benefit, it's going to be very, very granular how you use every single penny. And that's going to be part of the human capital game, is how do you manage your money? We know we gave you this little packet of tokens. How did you make the right choice with it? And that's the game, because it is all gamification. And I've been seeing this even in the lead in, like when, you know, 4 years ago in the schools, they were pushing financial literacy. Oh, we need to get all the kids financially literate, you know, whatever. And Well, no, you actually need to create an economy with living wage jobs. You know, that it's not that people are making all bad choices with their money, it's they don't have the money. But this game that is going to be set up, I think it's going to be tied into programmable money, which will be blockchain. But it will be most likely this central bank digital currency, not a decentralized. But if that were allowed to exist, they would just come shoot you down with the directed energy weapon. Like, they're just going to erase that and make that not an option. And so my concern is they're getting everyone bought in. So they're like, oh, this is not so bad. And then most people, when it flips to the central banking version, will be like, oh, we already did that before. It's the same as this other kind. And it's like, nope, it's not. Something totally different. And yeah. That's not even to go into the other, the no, smart contracts. But programmable money is important.
Yeah, no, and I think it is worth going into because it's going to be connected to it. Because it's very much like the way the internet was talked about. Look at this whole idea that there was a spreading that was taking place. But now you can see once everything's kind of locked in, the spreading is ended and it all starts to centralize and it all goes down one pathway. And now you have to watch the words you say on here. You have to, you know, we're worried about being taken off and deplatformed and da 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 da. And that's what's going to now happen with money. And look, last week when we were talking to Rob and Jake and we talked about how capitalism is predicated on theft, right? It started with the theft of human labor, whether not just in wages, but out of slavery. But once it was done with formal slavery, then it has the everyday theft of, that's what profit is. Profit is the stealing of the value of somebody's work from them and retaining it into those people who own the capital. Right. So now so you could at least say as a wage slave that you are somewhat free to do what you could with your wages. Well, digital currency means now not so much. Now it's like, well, okay, you have your wages, potentially, it's all digitized, but did you get vaccinated? Because if you didn't get vaccinated, I'm not sure those wages are going to be usable, you know? And all those sorts of things where a digital currency means that the people who can have control of that currency can control those of us who plan on using it. And
all the data is also value for those companies because as you were saying with Robinhood, that they made the money in the data. So by overlaying the programming, it's not simply the social control, but they're actually extracting further value in how you use in your social relationship to your own money. That's become data that then is like packaged as a valuable product for those same like vampiric entities. Yeah, the more you understand about the digital wallets, I mean, and that's, again, we're conditioning people to use money on an app, right? Like whether it's a stock transaction, it's not exactly the same as a digital payment, but that's very precarious, like having all your money on a phone, I mean, or on a device that you can access that can be turned off at will, because we know that, you know, there's sniffer drones that can, you know, pull the IP addresses and just whoop, turn it off, just especially if you're on public assistance, they just turn it off. And, you know, we saw in India recently with the farmer protests, like they got everybody on digital, you know, identity and everything. And then they just turned off the internet. Like, you know, we're done, you know, shut off the internet. And then where are you? And so I think it's not easy to extract. I mean, I'm not trying to say it's an easy position to be in, but like a lot of people keep talking about trust. And then like, what is currency actually, right? And what is the role of globalization? Because blockchain is in and of itself creating an artificial trust with entities that you have no clue about. It's not, you're not transacting with people you know or in your community. You might not even be transacting with an individual or an entity. Like it may just be an artificial construct that you're transacting with, but the blockchain is supposed to make it trustworthy. And so I keep saying, like, we need to actually interface this larger conversation about currency with globalization, like in telepresence labor, right? Because it's a race to the bottom for all of us. And, you know, I don't want to come at it from a nationalist standpoint, but people are not understanding the haptic robotic, like what the future of work is, and that everyone is going to be hurt. And so it shouldn't be a zero-sum game. Like, ultimately, I think we should all refuse to do this work this way. And like build local community. I mean, and not in antithesis to other countries, other cultures, like value them for what they are. But like, we shouldn't all be competing to do, like, I was looking at this Globotics paper from the UN and they were saying, oh, this is awesome with the robotics now. Workers in Kenya can clean hotel rooms through robots in Oslo. And Mexican gardeners can mow lawns in Texas from Mexico. And that's that is their mindset. So like, anyway, it's a bit, but that's the currency part, because it's the digital currency is global, and it sounds great about these fast, you know, transactions, but it's going to be weaponized against us. I don't know. I don't think we have the power in that equation, really.
I mean, so, you know, I sometimes think about, you know, about life prior to the iPhone, and, you know, how things have changed drastically, you know, life before COVID, and how we now, my mother was complaining about going to the doctor, you know, and like through video, and she's like, you know, it was already horrible. This is even worse. So I guess my question is, you know, I think we kind of asked this before, but how fast do you think this is moving? You said that it's moving fast, but I mean, the iPhone changed life drastically in a matter of like less than 15 years, right? I mean, we still don't know the repercussions of that generation that doesn't know life without the iPhone.
Yeah.
So how fast do you think this is moving? And to the point where, you know, we will be dependent on cryptocurrency, and you know, and again, there will be the ability to, for someone who's watching the game, right, from the distance, to just, you know, or someone or something, AI in this case, like how fast do you, is your best guess, or if you have anything to say about that?
I mean, it's, I don't have like a super, I mean, the timeframes that they talk about are like 2030, 2035, 2050. They're sort of like, those are the numbers that are generally sort of thrown out. Now, you know, we also have quantum computing and we have AI, and clearly people are concerned about what's happening. And, you know, China's more advanced in AI than we are because they have more training data sets. So, you know, clearly the COVID stuff has put everything on fast forward because it's created a giant state of exception. You know, so we're living in this perpetual state of exception that's going on a year now where you don't have access to your elected officials. You can't, like, you know, I was talking with some folks and they were talking about trying to lobby, you know, at the Capitol. I mean, you can't go to the Capitol. I mean, what are you going to stalk them on Zoom? Like, you can't. It's like everything that we understood about normally how normal civil society works has been set aside in favor of advancing this flip. So, you know, and I would have thought by now there would be more pushback or more people questioning. I mean, my goodness, it really is almost a year that this isn't going to be normal, but I guess many people have made it normal. So it feels like it's just the policies and writing on the rails, you know, that they've done a lot. Now that said, I like, just like your mom, I don't think most people want this. And so I think eventually my husband keeps saying, they'll get sick of it. And I'm like, have they sick of it yet? Like, you know, so, you know, but we have to stay off blockchain. To me, that's the thing, the blockchain identity, we have to stay off of blockchain. And I believe that is going to be tied to the vaccine credential initiative. And that is Oracle, and that is Microsoft, and that is Salesforce, and that's MITRE, and that's Commons Project. And these are powerful, powerful players. And so will we have standing for people, even people who, you know, advocate the idea of getting a vaccine or doing these things, will they then go the next step and say, there's an expectation that everyone carry these papers? And that, I think, is where the rubber meets the road, because if people roll over for that, I think it's going to be very hard to roll it back. And that decision will probably happen in the next 12 to 24 months.
I just have a question, a follow-up. And so how do we stay out of the blockchain? How do we, you know, how does someone, you know, besides obviously learning, getting more informed, how do you maybe try to stay out of the blockchain?
Well, I mean, it's an education process. I mean, that's the thing, because even people, like, people are being sold, and I think to a certain extent, and it's not anybody's fault, because everybody would like to like an answer. You know that there's this sort of dire feeling like, we need the answer. And I'm like, it's a process. If you don't actually understand how the problem came about, you're not, the answer that they're going to deliver to you is probably just going to make the problem worse, even though initially it might seem like it's the answer. It's not going to be the right answer. And so I think Bitcoin is that. It's fulfilling the need to have an answer, but it actually is a master's tool thing that's just going to double down on being a bigger problem. And, you know, no shade on the people who don't know the larger situation about, I mean, essentially what's coming with this blockchain world is that, imagine like the early days of hyperlinks, right? And how amazing that was, that you could click on a link and new information would open up. Like there'd be a new tab. Like that was conceptually. So imagine that concept in the real world, in the physical world, that instead of links, everything is layered with information, and not just information, but maybe rights and privileges on how you interact with it. And that some things are permissioned and some things aren't permissioned. Like, you know, you sometimes you click on a link and it'll say, well, you have to log in, or you don't have permission to look at this. That your the physical world becomes that. And that is all running on blockchain, because blockchain was set up to track digital assets. Assets, physical and digital, any kind of asset in a digital world. That's because capitalism went into the virtual world, and blockchain is what's allowing capitalism to function in virtual worlds. So, you know, I'm just trying to educate people about this part of it, because I think people are being led in a waves to like, Bitcoin is the answer, Bitcoin is the answer. And then it'll be very hard to pivot, go like, wait, Bitcoin isn't, like, there's other stuff. There's stuff about, like, you know, I can't go in the store without my QR code on blockchain. This is the same thing as Bitcoin. They don't know. And so, like, I just, you know, spent 4 or 5 days in Utah, you know, telling people there, because it's a hotbed of all of this, including Evernym, which is running the blockchain identity system. And I'm trying to tell people, like, I'm not on it yet because I haven't been put in a situation that compels me to be on it yet. I'm really worried for my kid who's in college. You know, I'm worried about those kids in Chula Vista who have a blockchain health record potentially when they go back to school to get their COVID tests. You know, I don't know how to protect everybody other than, because it would have to be a mass movement, I think. Right. And to me, framing it as an abolition movement, it's actually like a preemptive abolition movement. Like, before we get blockchain, we should just not do it. And it's like, but first you have to actually tell people it's slavery. It's a vast expansion of the idea of enslavement, like global enslavement, and then convince them of that and then say, let's not do it. And it's a big task. I don't know. Like, I wish I had a better, but I don't think you can tell people not to do it unless they understand it, and they don't understand it. Yeah.
It seems almost inevitable though, right? It's just, everything is, you want to read an article, you have to make an account. You have to go onto an app, you have to make an account. It just seems very inevitable. And it almost, I was talking to a friend who said that that's why there are also these internet battles of trying to anonymize a lot of things on the internet. So you're not necessarily being, but then even if you're anonymized, there's still a trace, some part of you, you know? It's like on social networks, like what we just recently tried to have on our platform, because we're afraid of having our episodes be taken off of YouTube because of some of the things that we have said. Anything around COVID has to have some tag, or, you know, or some of the things that people have said are outlandish to some, to others, no, it depends, or conspiratorial to others. And we post stuff now on LBRY, Libri, or Library. And there's also another social network like Minds. And these people can see for themselves how it's very different from YouTube or Facebook. And the concept is that no company is in control or can delete your account. And each user can see that a posted video or material wasn't altered by anyone else. And so this is, I guess, the counter way of what people are trying to do. Like my friend Jake, who thinks that we should try to go all cryptocurrency and all just anonymize everything, and just shouldn't be having any sort of accounts with your personal information on it. And whether we agree or disagree, it could potentially also, as I was reading in the New York Times article, be where, if Donald Trump's account was shut down, he could then move all of his followers onto another platform. He is actually shut down, but he could move to another network instead of losing them all, his followers, because you then don't have to have any you're not held accountable by any company. I don't know what you make of that, Alison, if that is maybe the way to go, to anonymize or to even have more control of the internet by just, again, it's all decentralized, anonymized, no accounts, and have the chaos of the internet be the way.
See, I don't think that it's actually going to be chaotic, because what they're going to do is create a digital identity where everything sticks, like all your digital dust, acute, you know, big chunks, little chunks, it's all like goes into your locker, you know, your permanent record locker. And the sell is that, like, oh, great, you own your data. Isn't this great? Which kind of, but it's sort of a false choice in that respect, because I think, one, most people aren't talking about the Enigma protocol, which allows, like MIT created it and allows a querying on encrypted data. So it would stay anonymous, but it would allow for things like the impact investors to run queries on people's data in aggregate. You know, so they could say, well, here's a cohort of people who all received some sort of evidence-based treatment for addiction. Let's run the numbers and see if there was an impact, right? Or here's a whole cohort of people who are, you know, pre-diabetic and they're getting, we gave them all smart shirts. You know what I mean? Like, let's go in and we can run all that data and see if the smart shirts had an impact. And, you know, and I do think that even the poor will end up selling their data as like the plasma bank, right? So that'll be the next, like, you get a UBI, but then you sell your data to like make a little, like, do you want to, you know, have a nice dinner once in a while, like sell some of your data and then you can get that. So the choice is presented that no matter what, we have to become a digital brand, and either someone else can own our digital brand and manipulate it, or we have control of our digital brand. But they're not, no one is saying what is an alternative that means that we can live our life not as a digital brand. And that's kind of the framing. And, you know, that is like, at this point, it seems like however that would start for people who want to make that choice would be small. But, you know, is that, you know, we become hermits in the desert or something? You know, I don't know. But like, it seems to me that if the idea of a natural human life or natural life on this planet that is outside of these larger systems of gene therapies and nanotechnology were to try to exist, like someone's going to have to take that stand, even if it's just a tiny group. And so some of it is like, how do you define success? And that's it for me. And people define it differently. Like if you're looking for a mass movement, I don't think it's going to start that way. But I think that there is something worthy in people who might try to take a hard line of not using the tools, because the choice that if everybody uses the tools, the world is going to change and may not be irreparable.
Yeah. And I think so when you sent me that thing, Alison, about looking into digital identity, and so many of the questions that were posed, and these are people selling digital identity and saying how it was going to be more transparent, more easy for the user, more private, okay? They always came back to the question of, who are you? That was the question they came down to. And I was like, that's an interesting question. I know who I am. So why is that question at the heart of digital identity? Because that who are you question isn't important for me. It's important for all the places I need to go. And it's about
know your customer.
Right. It's about establishing gates for me and decide. And somebody has to decide whether I can walk through that gate. So they have to know who I am. If I am on the dashboard, who does the dashboard say I am? What is my identity as it's put together by this thing? And do I meet a certain criteria? Is my temperature high enough that I can get into certain places like a school? Does it say that based on biometrics or whatever, anything I've done, does it say that I'm free to do it? So really, people are thinking about blockchain as if we're living in this neutral people sim world that we're just going to walk around like avatars. We live in a capitalist society of control and regulation. And regulation isn't regulation. The only reason regulation exists is to regulate the fact that capitalists can never lose. They must always win. The whole point of regulation. The winners win. So there will be regulation on blockchain. It will establish that that the winners will continue to win, because that's the nature of the game. So who am I is only something that's important for the capitalists to know so they can control me. And they can tell me where I can go. And the reality is there's not going to be like some Edward Snowden secret app to get yourself out of this thing. Like, it is going to require a revolution. It is going to require an uprising of the scale that we're seeing in India that's going to be determined to undo what is trying to be done to us. We're not going to stumble accidentally into a non-technocratic dystopia. We are going to have to come together and identify where we're being taken by these people and decide to go somewhere else. And that's going to take hard work. We're going to have to undo a lot of, like, they are going to get us on blockchain based on how successful they were with around this GameStop thing. They were able to take this big guys get richer story and turn it into this thing where little guys, so-called little guys, go flooding into the market, and then they're going to get fleeced again. And they're not little guys. These are just, we're all nobodies. The little guys make us look like tiny little, you know, whatevers. This is big guys and getting defeated by bigger guys. And we're all looking at this like somebody just got taken down. And the only people getting taken down are us. And so we just have to understand that, like, there's no way of controlling this stuff, this infrastructure, because it's being made by them, and it's going to be controlled by them, and it's going to be used to control us. And so that's the part that I'm like, I get dismayed over how much awareness collectively we are going to have to come to, because to undo this, it's going to take a lot, not just a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of understanding about the world that's being constructed for us.
And for me too, I think it's a race against time, just to kind of bring it back to my question that, you know, that like the way I see it, you know, maybe it's implicit in your argument, Lipson, but is that, you know, those gates are also going to gatekeep, you know, dissenters, you know, political dissenters and people who want to fight the system. And so, you know, we will be even more isolated, you know, as it is. We feel, some of us, you know, that talk about, you know, these things. We are censored by our peers at times. But now in a system where they have so much control as to who you are, right, in the real world, you know, they don't have to kill you physically. They can just kill you virtually and they can just outcast you. And, you know, again, someone or AI or whatever, the person looking at the board that has all the data sets, you know, they can pick and choose, you know, and we in pretending that we can have any control of that, to me, is kind of ludicrous, you know, that. And so, yeah, it's a race against time, and, you know, we will have to get creative. But ultimately,
I think there might be parallel universes. I think we may have time bending. I think there we may have more. There may be stuff going on that we don't fully appreciate.
I want change in this universe.
I know, but I don't know. I just
set with that one.
I mean, the thing is, like, and that's why, and I know this is probably not super popular, but like I think that it's a spiritual engagement. Like, not necessarily organized religion, but actually, like, there's an energetic system beyond technology. And I think, and I'm sure it's probably really hard to be in California that is so tech steeped in the tech, in the app culture. But I think that that is the false choice. And there's a much more powerful energetic system that if we could figure out how to tap into that, like, to me, that feels like a part of it. Because even in India, as you know, I've mentioned that many of the people who are really grounded in, like, on the front lines of that movement, they're people of the Sikh faith, and they're like, this is our destiny. We're either going to do this or we're going to die trying. This is our, you know, we are doing this thing. And, you know, granted, they have a mass movement, but I do think that it's interior. Like, there's both organizing work, and Andy, I know, like, a lot of your work is focused on outward organizing, but I think that there is a certain amount of internal awareness and, like, cultivating our internal, like, power in the face of this domination. And to me, understanding this technology, and you know, I keep going back to more of, like, indigenous knowledges and doctrine of discovery and scientism and, in quote unquote, enlightenment, that I think it goes all the way back. And it's the matter of our relationship to one another and the earth as natural systems. And that somewhere along the lines, you know, white Western Europe got the idea that they were man was above nature, that man could control nature, that that was progress, that the domination over nature and the world meant that we were progressing and that that was a benefit. And that it's, this trajectory has just gone crazy. And so now we can not only dominate, you know, nature and the bees and mining, and we're dominating each other's bodies down to the cells. And so like, it feels like a mental illness really. And that's why I think it's like a sacred connection, and also something that, again, I'm not trying to co-opt Indigenous practice, but like that to me feels like the antithesis of the technocracy is something that is actually steeped in the real world and real relationships, not blockchain. Like blockchain is trying to sort of make Western scientism logical. And I'm like, the only logic in it is sort of brutality. That's kind of the inherent logic of the system.
This, can I ask a question that I, as I'm a follower of Alison on Facebook, and so I have something around, it's still related obviously, but it is something around her recent travel, just because we have her here. Yeah. You went and you were near the building of Ancestry.com, right? And unfortunately, before I got to know all of this blockchain and all of the digital currencies and the Internet of Human Bodies and the Internet of Things, I did my Ancestry test. So unfortunately, now I'm tracked forever.
I mean, the thing is, we're probably, you know, all, you know, I try to keep track of my hairbrush, right?
Yeah. What, if I may, because we're talking about here how we have to attempt to stay off the blockchain, attempt to stay off the grid, so to speak, and not be so interested in being recorded or data driven. How is it that then in your recent travels did you what do you make of Ancestry and all of that mapping and as well as people trying to figure out and trace back their ancestors through the internet?
So part of one of the things that I was doing on my, you know, putting together my talk, because I'd known for a long time that the Salt Lake City region was a center for educational technology. And I'm kicking myself because I forgot that at Western Governors University, which is one of the largest online competency-based education programs, was there, and I didn't go there, which is like making me crazy because now they're doing blockchain stuff too. But they have 1,000 life sciences companies, you know, in the state of Utah. And, you know, that's a striking number, 1,000. I mean, it's not even a super populous state, and they've got 1,000 life sciences companies. And actually, it goes way back to the origins of the internet, like in the late 60s, and the development of, you know, bioinformatics and gene prototyping. And I think the first artificial heart was there. Like, they were doing all of this health work. And also the Huntsman family, which has ties to Penn, you know, they're a chemical company, but then their philanthropy was in cancer genomics. And so if we understand the other piece of Utah is that like a lot of that money came out of mining. They had these giant copper mines. So these beautiful mountains and then this giant like open air mines. And I sort of feel like now our bodies are the next mined commodity, like mineable commodities. And it's very interesting because several of these key players in the ed tech space, Pavel Leksha, who's a transhumanist out of Skolkovo, who was doing this Global Education Futures Map, his background was in mining. Tom Vander Ark, who is the former Gates guy, who is in charge of Global Education Futures here, his background was in mining. So it's very odd that these mining interests are now like in technology, but there is a through line through that. And so, you know, this might sound a bit overboard, but I mean, there is a very clear transhumanism program. The people in power are interested in, you know, I talk about like AI as the end game settler colonizer, and it's all of humanity. Like if the idea of settler colonization is erasure, like through genocide or cultural assimilation, just erasure of that natural humanity is the target of this, all of it. And so there's this pathway towards that erasure that's happening, but the profit is being extracted all the way down. So there may be a depopulation element. There may be a, we want to turn you into a digital avatar element. Like you know, I don't know if these crazy people think that they're going to bring down the planet and then they're going to somehow upload their consciousness into a spaceship and go somewhere. Like, I don't put it past this. Like, I'm not saying I think that's a good idea, but I do think that based on what they're talking about, their technologies, that they are imagining some space travel and like re-engineering a human body and consciousness into fit that paradigm. Not that it's the choice that we would make, but it's the choice that's being made by these crazy billionaires like the Musks and the Bezoses and these space programs. So to me, the genomic sequencing is both the profit extraction and then the predictive profiling of, like, on the one hand, for social impact investing and making money on betting on people in that way. But two, I think it may also be identifying who are the candidates for this small subset of humanity that's going to be allowed to proceed into some transhumanist program, and that it's potentially bioprospecting or biopiracy, which you know, we know that they have done that in indigenous communities for a long time, like people who have unique genomic sets that they've gone in and said, you know, we really care about your diabetes here. Let me like get like samples from all you guys, and then have misused it. So that precedent is there. You know, it's somewhat speculative on my part, but I think it's multi-pronged. One, it's extraction, straight up profit for life sciences companies. Two, it's profit for these human capital portfolios and the predictive analytics around chronic illness. And then three, I think it's also genetics of behavior and trying to pick and choose some sort of, I think it's eugenics. And is there like a, you know, a super race, whatever they would imagine that to be, that would be suited to this digital, you know, some sort of transhumanist future that's maybe based in shifting from carbon to silicon based life, which is crazy. I mean, it sounds really crazy. I never thought I would have to talk about this stuff. I mean, I know, you know, I keep always saying, like, I was just fighting standardized testing. That's really what I thought. You know, I didn't know it was cyborgs. I really didn't know that that's where it was going. But I think knowing the health sciences, the life sciences are a huge piece of this. And don't feel bad, because like tons of people, like literally, who knows if they're collecting DNA in these test kits? Like, people keep asking me, are there nanoparticles? Are they collecting DNA? I'm like, I don't have any security clearance. You think they're going to tell me? Like, they're not going to be straight up about it. But, you know, if they can do it and it's profitable for them, they probably are. We might not know it for 10 years, but.
And it is profitable to have information about people. And
yeah,
you can, and it is right to describe it as erasure, but it is erasure that's being driven towards the god of productivity and efficiency. Like, everything must be erased that doesn't lead to something that will produce something and that will do it efficiently. And if it does it more efficiently, then that's the way it's going to be done. If it produces more and more efficiently, then that's the way it's going to be done. And that is what is driving this. And it's a, but I will also say, the part that I don't think we get much time on is, I think there's a competition for that. Like, there's a competition over that efficiency. There's a competition over that productivity. And I still believe that that is going to lead to, you know, a bitter war that I personally don't think there's much of an end game after the next bitter major war, which is World War III, in my opinion. That is my sense of time ticking. Because I, you know, when I hear defense people in the U.S. military saying that there will have to be a reckoning with China before 2050, like, they're saying that they're going to, China's going to have to get reckoned with by 2050, or they will, you know, overcome the United States as a global economic power. Then that tells me these people are serious, and they have serious scenarios of limited nuclear war in which they see themselves as winners. That tells me that these people believe that there's a win through that. And
see, that's why I think it's a peace movement. I mean, I think for me, and it may sound outlandish, but this AI threat, like the threat of militarism, and however that's manifested, whether it's through nuclear, I mean, the stuff that's coming with the nanotech, I feel like nanotech is actually more scary to me than some of the nuclear stuff, because it's invisible and you don't even know. So essentially, it's the people who care about natural life on the earth for the future generations of all living things. And to me, that's a unifying prospect. If we can reframe the narrative, because we actually all have to save the world together. And I don't think most, you know, I still feel like in my heart that most people of the world care for each other. Like most people of the world are not warlike. It's that these crazy finance interests, military interests that foment war to continue to accrue power. But I don't believe it's most regular people.
That is the other, for me, that's the other part of what makes masks and seeing like 6-year-olds being raised and on masks. Because I do think that is actively part of chipping away at people's sense of connection to each other. That is limited by the system we are in. But it's even being etched away more when you have this all this separation and all this fear of each other, and each of us seeing as a potential threat to each other through some biological thing or what have you. I don't feel it's an accident that is the narrative that's in play, and that it's, and so all those things which I think socializing and being feeling like part of a society is natural. I feel like they're trying to see if they can undo that.
Yep.
So I personally am ready to conclude soon, if that's all right.
Yeah.
But I did want to, I think we started off with GameStop fiasco and then, you know, talking about the stock exchange around that and how there's a game, as well as we delved from there into the cryptocurrencies. And of course, always, Alison led us into that rabbit hole of hers, of Olaf, Alice in Wonderland. Alison in Wonderland of the cryptocurrency world. Excuse me, crypto of the internet, the internet of things world.
This week is spatial computing.
It's hard not to be led by you, Alison, and sucked into the internet of things. But it's always a very important conversation. Before this conversation, I was feeling a little down because of my struggle in trying to support families to reopen schools and to get off the internet and go back to rudimentary fundamentals. And this conversation is reinvigorating in the sense that it gives me the opportunity to to be with other like-minded folks and to understand that this is important, and the lucha, the struggle to continue is ongoing.
We carry the ember.
Yes. it's funny, as I'll conclude here, how you said you started off with standardized testing and then delved into this area. And I think that's maybe not where I'm heading at this very moment, but it seems like when I'm talking about the reasons why we should reopen, it's been from the emotional sanity and the emotional part of it, but then also we just need to get away from all of this surveillance and the data that's being collected by us, by big mega companies. So it's, there's no way around it. How do you sell it though? That's my struggle. I'm trying, and Andy and I have our differences in trying to encourage and trying to talk about this stuff with our families and fellow teachers, educators. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to say, Alison, that I always appreciate your, you know, your attention to the spiritual part of this, all this. Like, I don't think it's separate. I don't, you know, I think on a personal level, like, I've had to go through like a transformative experience to be who I am now and challenge these things, in to redefine who I am, to find out who I am and not let these systems tell me who I am, you know, who I want to be. And so I do think that's part of, you know, revolution for me, that we will have to, you know, take control of who we are,
yeah,
and fight those forces that want to tell us who we should be. I don't think it's, it will get intensified, and, you know, we're in a race, I think, but I don't think it's that, I think I've gone through that experience to some degree, you know, just dropping out of college and saying, I don't want to become who they're telling me who I want to be, you know. And so just thank you for keep bringing that back. But I do think, you know, we have to pay attention to that. I think that, again, the revolutionary process or the challenging of all this is transformative, because it has to be personal. You know, you have to do it for yourself. You have to do it for the people you love. You know, I find refuge in Buddhism. You know, I'm kind of new to it, but you know, this quote, but you know, the saying that if your community suffers, you will suffer too. You know, and vice versa. If you suffer, your community will suffer. So, you know, we are connected. The solutions are, that's why I'm a communist. You know, the yeah. solutions are, the antithesis to individualism and this separation, this fragmentation, to me is community. And we're going to have to do something together and find a way, but through individual transformation as well. And so I do appreciate, you know, that you give us, I always stay thinking for weeks after I talk to you. But thank you for challenging, you know, for making us think more, for sharing this, for the hard work you do to transform yourself, I imagine, to keep, you know, answering questions. And so, yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate this conversation all the time.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I mean, I sort of feel like you guys are all gifts. I mean, I really, I'm like this conduit for all sorts of people sharing things with me, you know, and then I kind of sit with it. And then I have, for whatever reason, people want to talk to me so I can share it back out, right? It's, these aren't all my, like, sort of a fermentation process, right? Or a compost pile. I talk about like a compost, like throw all these things in, like let it heat up and stir it around. And then you've got some nice like loam, hopefully at the end. But I think that's, and I'm sorry, it feels like, I'm sure it's so hard to be in that geography where you guys are. Like, I mean, Philadelphia isn't great. And I don't really even go out of my house that much. It was great actually to go to Utah. And that's the thing. Like, I think we have to get beyond some of like the stereotypes of how we imagine people to be, because like on paper, it would be like, you're doing what? And I'm like, but these were transformative experiences together, right? Like people coming together from a heart space because we're trying to do the same thing. Like, and then we grow together. So it's like a muscle. Like the more you like sort of are able to risk and put it out, like over time, people, when you're doing that from a place of authenticity, it attracts the other people. Like we build each other up maybe without even knowing it. And so, so I'm glad that I can be that for you, and you guys are that for me too, you know, cause that's the community, even though, gosh, I keep saying, I'm like, I want everybody to get together. Like, I'd like to be like on the edge of a lake with a cabin and a bonfire and some guitar music and like food. And maybe I keep thinking one day that we'll have all of that. We'll like find the place to have all of the people together.
Well, once I get vaccinated, I can get on a plane.
I just have to get vaccinated to go. I'm going as much as I can to like those stupid things roll out.
I'm kidding. Kidding. Ugh. No, I appreciate it, Allison. And I'm really glad we could do this episode today.
All right, so let's conclude. That does it for this week's episode. Allison is a mom and independent researcher in Philadelphia who blogs at Wrench in the Gears. Again, that is wrenchinthegears.com. She started her activism and around public education first, as she said earlier, fighting standardized testing, then ed tech, and eventually realized the push by global finance to turn everything into data for the purpose of digital surveillance. And profit meant that she had to expand her work beyond schools and started digging into the global poverty management complex. So thank you, Allison, for being here with us. It's always been a pleasure, and we hope to have you on again next time. What's Left is a weekly political podcast on our channel, Challenging the Mission Left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast / channel there and connect with us. I remind folks, if you like anything you have heard here, please jot this down. Share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 8 platforms now. On podcast, you can find us on Spotify, iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, and on channels on BitChute, Library, LBRY, Odyssey, ODYSEE, or YouTube. If you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda.
Bye-bye.